Okay. We, mainly you, have a test this Friday. Is that right? Just want to remind you.
I don't really have a test this Friday.
No. Huh? Well, I could move it up. You'd rather have it tomorrow? No, I'm flexible. We won't go past Friday. I'm not that flexible. Okay, we left off in Jeremiah chapter 11, verse 22. Now, in verse 21, he's told them to prophesy not. The men of Anathoth had told him to prophesy not in the name of the Lord. They were mad at what he was saying. They were upset at him. They thought he wasn't of God. They thought he was speaking out of his own mind. And so they were telling him not to prophesy in the name of the Lord, lest they kill him as part of the judgment that was supposed to happen because of Deuteronomy chapter 13. You don't have to fear a prophet, and a false prophet can be stoned. So they were willing to put to death Jeremiah because he was a false prophet in their eyes. It's really interesting that in reality they didn't follow the law anywhere else, but here they were willing to follow the law. I think we'll find this in the days ahead. It's interesting. You watch the actions of the ACLU. They're willing to follow any law that promotes liberalism, promotes their causes. They're willing to do anything to promote that. But when you run into a law that is conservative, that might in some way enhance godliness and righteousness, why? No. That law is not a right law. We're going to strike that law down. Rather curious state of affairs. I think we can understand the source of it. Verse 22. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will punish them. The young men shall die by the sword, and their sons and their daughters shall die by famine. Now, this is going to literally happen, but it's also speaking of a famine of the Word of God, as we see in Amos chapter 8, verse 11. Because of their unwillingness, God said there would be a famine. He said, behold, the days come, saith the Lord God, that I will send a famine in the land, not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of the Lord. That's a fearful time. It really is a fearful time. See, the Word of God is supposed to be our meat, you know, our bread. That's what sustains us. That's the manna. And it's a sustenance that's spiritual. And when God says, I'm going to send a famine for the Word of God, I don't want to be around then. I want to be gone. I want to be either that, or I want to have found a place where I can be hidden in caves, so to speak, and be fed. Or like Elijah, and have the Spirit of the Lord come down, an angel of God come and feed me, and go on the strength of that 40 days, you know, the time of testing and trials. I don't want to be in the land when Ahab's around and there's no food, and it was Samaria when it was besieged, and they call a cab of dove's dung was going for 5 shekels of silver or something like that. I'm not interested in eating dove's dung. I want to be fed from the Word, you know. And if we will be fed from the Word, there'll never be a famine. Not spiritually. There'll never be a famine. If we'll be open and if we'll really allow Him to feed us through that Word, there'll never be a famine. Ever. Not in our lives. Never. The Christian world out there is suffering from this famine, and they're eating dove's dung and asses' heads, and they really are. That's the truth. And they don't know it. And they think it's good. But one day, God's going to break forth, and there's going to be a man-child company, and they're going to be in a state where they're willing to believe, where they're willing to believe that God can feed them, and He will feed them at that day. But He's going to bring them right, way down low. He has to first, to get them hungry, really hungry, till they really realize what they're feeding on. Till they see that they're eating their own children, as it were. Verse 23, "And there shall be no remnant of them, for I will bring evil upon the men of Anathoth, even the year of their visitation." Judgment is going to be reaped from what has been sown. See, they're attacking God's anointed. He said, "Touch not my prophets, touch not mine anointed, and do my prophets no harm." But because they were unwilling before God, they couldn't even recognize that He was their prophet. And so they're going to reap judgment for it. Now, this year is probably a figurative year, emphasizing the severity of the chastisement. It's not just a day, it's a year. We're talking a long time here. And visitation is literally punishment. Even the year of their punishment. Chapter 12. "Righteous art thou, O Lord, when I plead with thee. Yet let me talk with thee of thy judgments. Wherefore doth the way of the wicked prosper? And wherefore are all they happy that deal very treacherously?" Now you'll notice, Jeremiah is pleading here with the Lord. Now this word plead has something of the idea to complain or to quarrel or to strive. Not in an angry, demonic way, but more in confusion and not understanding. And this question has been asked by other good men of God. But you'll notice he first starts off with, "Righteous art thou, O Lord." In other words, he's justifying God. But he's saying, "Lord, I don't understand. Let me plead with you. Let me strive with you a little bit here. I mean, it's not a quarrel in the sense of he's angry with God, but I'm not understanding. We've got to talk this out, Lord. You know, I've got to understand what's going on here. Wherefore doth the way of the wicked prosper? Wherefore are all they happy that deal very treacherously?" Now when he says, "Yet let me talk with thee of thy judgments," it's because he's vexed. Now he's looking at the natural prosperity of the wicked. They seem to have no problems. That's the way it appears, isn't it? It really is the way it appears. I know I dealt with a lot of people. I used to see an average of probably, anywhere from 200 to 500 people a day. And they're all from the park down here, or not all of them, a good portion of them. And a number of them had money, you know. They drove up in their Mercedes and their Cadillacs and, you know, nice cars and wore nice clothes. And I mean, they're not the extremely wealthy or anything, but they were well off. Comfortable. I mean, probably a little more comfortable than most of us, you know. You know, I had one lady come in that probably wore $100,000 worth of diamonds on one hand. Easily that much. I have no idea. I mean, I could be off by 10 times that much. I mean, I have no idea. It's just that her whole hand lit up, you know. And, you know, I mean, she had a brand new Mercedes 450 every year. And the old one went down to their place in Palm Springs so that they'd have a car to drive when they were down there. And the one that had been in Palm Springs, they gave to their daughter. See, you know, I mean, they're well off. You know, walked in their obviously expensive furs, but it looks like they're doing great. You know, and they didn't. I mean, you know, they weren't the scum of the earth in terms of wickedness, but yet they're real hard, cold, and backbiting, and you know, I mean, it was very evident. A lot of pride, but looked like they were doing great. Really, had another man used to come in. He'd buy two inch thick steaks. He'd buy up about $150 at a time, you know, and store them in his freezer, because he had, you know, T-bone, porterhouse, you know, the finest steaks. That's what he had for every meal, you know, just about. And he had his $44,000 Mercedes, and he'd joke about my car all the time. Which is about a $4.40 one, you know. Lanny and I are having a contest to see who can drive the most useful car, shall we say. Most functional vehicle. Anyway, And he'd come in, how you doing today? He'd be doing great. Every day he was just doing just fine. But you know, that man was really empty. I mean, on the outward, it looked like he was doing really well. And he had the other people in the store pretty well fooled, too. But I knew. I could see right through that. That man lives an empty life. Empty. You know, he bragged about how he bought his house from somebody who used to go to the chapel here. Or somebody who does go to the chapel here. He's down in the park. And he says, yeah, I spent $150,000 making it livable. After that, you know. He knew I went to the chapel, you know. But his life was empty. Empty. The prosperity of the wicked. Now, this has stumbled a lot of people. It really has. And nowadays, what's happening is the church is turning and saying, wait a minute, the prosperity belongs to the Christian. We should be prosperous like the wicked. Well, in one sense, that's true. It depends on what your focus is. Job was the richest man. He was the richest of men. But his focus wasn't on his wealth. And his focus wasn't on attaining that wealth. I want to be spiritually rich. If I'm materially blessed also, then that is just grace upon grace, and I certainly won't turn it down. But first I want to be spiritually rich. Because if I'm not spiritually rich, it doesn't matter what else I have. Who cares? Who cares? Job asked the same thing, Job chapter 21, verses 1 and 7. He asked the same thing. Now, he had been rich, and he was a righteous man. But he also saw the prosperity of the wicked. Asaph also in Psalm 73, verses 2 through 9. And the answer is, the wicked will pass away and judgment will come. In other words, we walk by faith and not by sight. Our prosperity is not based upon what it looks like. It's not whether you wear silk shirts or... yours are a little bit older and they're made of just good old-fashioned cotton or polyester or whatever it is. That's really immaterial. It doesn't really matter. If God blesses you and you can live in fine house and nice car and clothes and still tithe and give an offering and be generous and God continues to bless you, that is just wonderful. And that's just delightful. You know, sometimes we get into this mode of, and this has been prevalent in the church too, is that if you're really a holiness Christian, you will not be wealthy. If you're really walking with God, you will not be wealthy. That's contrary to the scriptures too. That's just the tradition that we've set in our own mind because of the poverty that the devil has put upon the people of God and the poverty mentality he's put upon the people of God. I have no problem with being blessed. There are people in our assembly who do quite well, who are what we would consider wealthy, not necessarily by world standards, but there are people in our assembly that make over $100,000 a year, you know, and that you just go, wow, you know, and they live comfortably, but you know, they tithe and they're always giving. I know several. They're always giving, always giving. And there's people that make less than that, you know. I mean, $50,000 a year is a lot of money too. I mean, probably 20,000 or maybe 10 is a lot to some of you. I don't know. Maybe 5 is. But, you know, if I had $5, I'd be rich, you know. That kind of feeling. But see, that's really immaterial. It doesn't matter. Because that's going to pass away. The riches of this world, the blessings of this world are all going to pass away. And it only matters where your treasures are, whether they're laid up in heaven or on earth. If they're on earth, they're going to pass away. But see, there's nothing wrong with having them on earth if they're also in heaven. If your treasures are really truly in heaven and you've got treasures on earth, well, then you are rich. But if your treasures in heaven are tremendous and you have no wealth on the earth, you're still rich. In Christ, all things are ours. You know, you remember when Jacob wrestled and he crossed the river and went to see his brother Esau, and he sent for, you know, like 400 sheep and I don't know what all, I don't remember the numbers, but a very, very large gift to his brother Esau. And Esau gave it back to him, said, I'm very wealthy, I have very much. And Jacob gave it back to him again and said, I have all things. As a contrast to what Esau said, I have all things. Why? Because he'd wrestled with God, and now he's a prince and prevailer with God. I have all things. All things are mine in Christ. I can go out and enjoy the beauty of this world. I don't have to own a thing. You know, which is more beautiful, a flower or a silk shirt? You know, to go walk among the fields and see the, enjoy the beauty of God's creation. I would rather go walk through a field of flowers than through South Center. You know, there's a lot more glory, there's a lot more beauty, and there's a lot less grief to the soul. Those are the things. The wicked's going to pass away. Psalm chapter 37. Well, if we can really get our eyes fixed and see, you know, we've walked by sight all of our life. All of our life. It's only as we became Christians and as we begin to mature that we just barely begin to start walking by the Spirit and seeing things in a spiritual perspective. And it's so easy to slip back in to that walking by sight again. And we do it even in the church then. We walk in and think, maybe we'll get our minds off material blessings per se, and we're not thinking about those. But then we start looking about this person. Boy, he's always able to give a testimony. You know, I mean, you know, he's really rich in God in that sense. And maybe that's true, but maybe it's not. Maybe we're walking by sight again. Maybe we're giving more honor to the mouth instead of the less comely parts. And maybe God is going to honor the less comely parts. In fact, he is going to. But it's so easy to that same kind of a mindset to look at things differently. Those people that are really visible, you know, like Bible college teachers. Boy, you know, just wow. But you know, there are people in the assembly that are just absolutely solid rock. You know, and they're solid gold inside and precious saints of God, and they are ministering all the time, and they're not seen. They're doing things that are just marvelous before the Lord in His eyes. But we get our eyes fixed on these things. And I don't mean in any sense to demean leadership positions. I don't. You know, that is a blessing from God, and he does it for a special purpose. But we don't want to get our eyes fixed. Well, somehow that person is more worthy. Or we put them on a pedestal, lift them up. Because then what happens when they fall? We get stumbled too. Because we don't see that they're just basically you and I. I remember Earl shared something once. In fact, it was in this very class when I took it from him. He said, you know why Bible college teachers are Bible college teachers? He says, it's not because they're the most spiritual people in the church. It's because they can teach. That's the truth. That's the truth. Doesn't mean we can't be the most spiritual in the church, but that's not why the choice is made. When I was chosen, the pastor told me why. He said, you do this and this and this and this and this and this, and that's just what we need in a teacher. In other words, you can teach. So we'll make you a teacher. Now, there are other qualifications that go along with it, too. But, see, we got to get our eyes off these things. It'll help us to recognize, too, how much those in leadership need prayer. Because they're human beings, just like we are. Just like I am, just like you are. I don't know, I guess I'm there. Anyway, whatever. It really has caused me to take stock. I have a lot more respect. I mean, a tremendous amount. And not that I did not respect before. I mean, I had tremendous respect for the teachers and the elders before. But now I have a whole lot more. Because I understand. I see some things a little differently. I recognize how much the prayer is needed. Psalm chapter 37. Fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against the workers of iniquity, for they shall soon be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb. That's verses 1 and 2. And also verses 35 through 40. I have seen the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a green bay tree. Yet he passed away, and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. Mark the perfect man, and behold the upright, for the end of that man is peace. But the transgressor shall be destroyed together. The end of the wicked shall be cut off. But the salvation of the righteous is of the Lord. He is their strength in the time of trouble. And the Lord shall help them and deliver them. He shall deliver them from the wicked and save them, because they trust in him. That is far greater thing. That salvation is worth everything. It's worth everything. Might also compare here Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 15. He says, I guess we haven't gotten to there. Verse 2. That's for verse 2. He planted them. Thou hast planted them. Yea, they have taken root, they grow. Yea, they bring forth fruit. Thou art near in their mouth and far from their reins. So I want you to put here Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 15, where he said he planted them, a noble vine. How art thou become a strange vine, a degenerate plant unto me? He planted them. They have taken root, they grow. Yea, they bring forth fruit. Thou art near in their mouth and far from their reins. Now we've seen the fruit that they brought forth. The fruit has been wickedness, unrighteousness. Here they want to kill Jeremiah. Now the reins here refers to the soft parts, literally, or the kidneys. And therefore, as they viewed it, the heart and mind and affections, the way we use the word heart. Not speaking of that organ that pumps the blood, but the heart in the sense of your soul and your the way you think and act and your affections, your emotions and that kind of thing. Thou hast planted them. So God has planted us also. And we don't want to be like them that draw back into perdition. We don't want to be like them that are near in mouth and far in heart from Him. Verse 3. But Thou, O Lord, knowest me. Thou hast seen me and tried mine heart and toward Thee. Tried mine heart toward Thee. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and prepare them for the day of slaughter. This is what He's doing with us right now. He's trying our heart toward Him. The trying of your patience worketh faith. Or the trying of your faith worketh patience, excuse me. He's trying us toward Him. To see whether we'll be patient, we'll be those that'll wait upon Him, those that'll trust in Him. But the wicked. Now you remember, this is kind of a complaint that he's bringing forth. Not really an angry complaint, but it's, I'm not understanding this. Now you know me, but I want you, Lord, to take these wicked and pluck them out like sheep for the slaughter and prepare them for the day of slaughter. It kind of reminds me of the sons of thunder. You know, because they wouldn't receive the gospel in a town, they said, shall we call down fire from heaven and destroy the town? You know not what spirit you're of. You know, Jeremiah is complaining. He's not seeing that God knows what's going on. Well, this is another thing that happens, is the time frame. Jeremiah is thinking in terms of, Lord, I've been ministering, you know, and we don't know how long here, but he'd been ministering some time by this point. We don't know exactly. Probably a number of years. And he's saying, Lord, I've been preaching, I've been teaching, I've been bringing forth prophecy of destruction. So how come they're still prospering? Why hasn't it come to pass? We're so impatient. It's really amazing in one sense. You know, the prophecies will come forth, you know. God will say, well, this certain type of thing is going to happen. Just wait and see. And we think, well, you know, it's been a week already. Come on, Lord. It's been a week. Been a month. Pretty soon we forget about it. And then it happens 2 years down the road. And the pastor goes, now you'll remember, God gave that prophecy and here it is. And we go, oh yeah, that's right. But that's just 2 years. You know, some of these things, you know, he ministered for almost 40 years. It's a long time. A long time. Daniel prophesied, and in that one passage in chapter 9, he's talking about over 2,000 years of time. He didn't even know it. The Jews didn't see it either. You know, 2,000 years between the first half and the last half of the week. God's timetable is not our timetable. And we need to keep that in view. When God gives promises, God gave me a certain promise last spring, well, about a year ago. And I thought about it came to pass about 3 weeks later. As it turned out, it didn't. It took a whole year for the promise to come to pass. And it came to pass in a greater way than I ever thought. But anyway, I mean, we just have the wrong time frame sometimes. He's given me certain other promises. I'm learning. We will wait. We will wait. Maybe it's 5 years. Maybe it's 10. Maybe it's 15. Maybe it's 20. I know this for the promises he's given me, if they're really of him, and I just, you know, you just take those things, if God speaks to your heart, you say, well, Lord, you'll confirm it in the time when it's necessary, you'll confirm it. And I know that no matter how long it is from now, all I can do to prepare will be all that, it won't be enough in one sense. It won't be enough. I'll need more than I can possibly prepare for in whatever time I have, even if it's 20 years. I'll need all that time, but God will make up for the lack. Paul, you had a question?
What sort of a kind of spirit or heart is Jeremiah complaining in? Because other passages where people have complained, they've been rebuked.
He's going to get rebuked here too, but not sternly, not harshly. His complaint is more of, I'm not really understanding, and God is being merciful on him. I mean, if you project yourself into his situation, here you're bringing forth the heart of God, you're standing virtually alone, everybody's complaining against you, it doesn't seem like any of what you're saying is either even having any effect, nor is it coming to pass yet. Those around about you are calling you a false prophet, they're ready to stone you. Lord, you know, you don't think we wouldn't be on our knees going, Lord, now what? Why don't you confirm that calling in me one more time so that I really know that this is what you wanted me to do? Are you sure that he's coming in a place of, he's doubting God a little bit. He's doubting his calling a little bit. But it's not, because of his circumstances, God isn't going to rebuke him heavily. You know, Mary, when she asked, she kind of said, well, how can this be, seeing how I'm a virgin? God didn't rebuke her sternly. He didn't rebuke her sternly. Now, in another case, Zacharias, regarding John the Baptist, his rebuke was a little more stern because of his position. But still, it wasn't a really harsh thing. He just couldn't speak. He couldn't speak. God said, okay, I'll show you. I'll perform a miracle. You'll believe then. See? And it was still wasn't really harsh. Not really harsh. It's like when Jesus went to the Simon the Pharisee's house. Now, some of the Pharisees he rebuked very sternly. But Simon he didn't. Simon was a follower and a believer. That's why he invited Jesus to his house. Now, he didn't recognize his state, and therefore he was judging this harlot that came to his house. And Jesus' rebuke to him was, he gave him a story. And he said, now who will love more? He said, well, the one you've forgiven the most. He said, that's right. He that's forgiven much, loveth much. And that was Simon's rebuke. You don't recognize, Simon, that you really need to be forgiven that much. That's why you don't love me as much. You don't love me as much. But see, he didn't say, you generation of vipers, to him, you know. It depended on their position. Simon was in a certain place. So Jeremiah's in a certain place. And God's rebuke is really very mild. Very sweet, very tender, very comforting. That's really what happens. If you hear a prophecy in our assembly that is really harsh and really, really hard, the odds are that it came from the person's spirit. Because this assembly is moving on. Now, God does say things very directly. I have never heard one that really falls into that category. Okay? But if you did, there's a time when God will bring things really hard and harsh. But you know what? God always deals much more tenderly, much more sweetly and mercifully than we would. That's why I say it's probably from their own mind. Because, you know, people got to walk with God. You know, that's a young man's zeal. I know, I've experienced some feelings like that in years gone by. A young man's zeal and legalism mixed in with it and self-righteousness and all kinds of things, you know. thinking that it's the righteous indignation of the Lord, when all it is self-righteousness that's steaming and fuming in there. God is tender. He's merciful. And so Jeremiah's complaint is not, he's not really angry at God. It's taking the form of a little bit of complaining. Okay, a little bit of striving toward God, you know. I'm not understanding, Lord. Please tell me what's going on here. Verse 4. How long shall the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither for the wickedness of them that dwell therein? The beasts are consumed and the birds, because they said, he shall not see our last end. Now the land mourning here probably speaks of a drought that was coming, or might have been at the same very same time. In chapter 14, verse 1, it could have passed too, because of the there's no exact time frame on either on this whole section in here, so it might be in the midst of the drought. It could have been somewhat past. It's difficult to say, but it's speaking probably of the drought that is being referred to in chapter 14, verse 1. That's the land mourning, herbs in every field wither. See, he shall not see. That's what they say. He shall not see our last end. They're saying that they shall outlive Jeremiah. They're saying, Jeremiah, you're prophesying that we are going to be destroyed, but Jeremiah, we're going to live long past you. You're not going to make it. You're not going to live. You're the one that's prophesying destruction. Your own destruction is going to come upon you because you are proclaiming destruction against the chosen elect of God. Now in verse 5 and following, we're having God's answer. And this is the famous one that we've heard from our pastor. If thou hast run with the footmen, and they have wearied thee, then how canst thou contend with horses? And if in the land of peace, wherein thou trustest, they wearied thee, then how wilt thou do in the swelling of Jordan? See, that's really a pretty soft answer. It's a pretty soft answer. And so the softness of the answer tells us where Jeremiah's heart really was. God's not angry at him, but he's saying, Jeremiah, listen up here. Now, you think you've really had it rough up to this point. Well, I want you to know, Jeremiah, that things are liable to get a little more difficult. You know, we think that what we've been going through in the last few years here with deliverance and this whole move and the difficult times, and I mean, the devil has been raging. I mean, we're still in the greenhouse. It's the wind that's blowing in through the cracks, you know. We may laugh now, you may not laugh in a few years. But really, yes, we're moving into different places. I know somebody gave me a parallel. It's like we've been out in this bay working on a boat, learning how to sail in this boat, learning how to be merchantmen, so to speak, on this particular ship. And it's a nice, calm bay, you know. It's got a narrow neck so that the raging of the sea doesn't come in. Well, one of these days, and perhaps we've started already, it's difficult to say, we're going to actually go out through the neck of that bay and out into the real water. And then the storms may begin to rage a little bit more. The waves will be a little bigger, you know. We'll step into the real world, so to speak. Really, we're in a greenhouse. It's only now that we're beginning to deal with some heavier demonic forces. Tuggle brought that over the weekend. We really are. See, before, when deliverance first came, you know, we had these raging manifestations and all this wild things going on, and we went through quite a struggle to learn how to deal with all that and to handle it and to pray and to get rid of those spirits and to take power and authority over them, because we didn't really know what we were doing. But you know, those were the lowest echelon demons. Really, the lowest. We really haven't. Now, Don said the spirit that he prayed against was a prince spirit. Now, I talked to him, we talked earlier, and he said he wasn't really sure if it was a prince spirit. It just called itself a prince spirit. But it very possibly could have been. But it was a very powerful thing. But see, up to this point, we really haven't been dealing with those things. I think in some of the deliverance I've been praying with certain ones, I've been coming against some spirits that are much more powerful than I've ever dealt with before. Now, I wouldn't call them prince. They're more like a chief demon in somebody's life. I don't think there's necessarily that many people that have what you would call a prince demon within them, particularly Christians. It's possible, but I've dealt with some really powerful things, though. And it was a lot of work. It was a lot of spiritual effort to really stand firm against those things and see them defeated. I learned a lot about deliverance in the last couple months. I mean, a lot. But I think God is just kind of, we're still in boot camp, kind of, you know? Well, when you start out in boot camp, you know, they don't make you run 50 miles the first day in boot camp. Because they know you'll die. You will. You can't do it. You'll get about 2 miles and collapse on the road. I mean, what good does it do to say force somebody to go 50 miles if every one of them ends up in the medic tent or whatever it is, you know, passed out for the next week? You know, with the blisters and feet bleeding and, you know, knees all shot, and they don't do that right off the bat. Now, what they do, though, is they extend you beyond what you're capable of, and they do that every day. That's the only way you get strengthened, you know. If you ever lifted weights, you lift weights, and if you just lift weights until you get tired, you'll build a little bit. You'll maybe tone yourself up, but you don't actually build muscle until you do it, until it hurts. That's what they tell you. It's the last three repetitions of lifting weights when it seems that you can't possibly lift it and it hurts to do it, where you actually begin to build muscle. So that's what's been happening with us spiritually. It's not until it really stretches us until it hurts. See, in the case of muscles, there's a certain, almost like an injury that occurs to the muscle tissue at that point. And that causes the muscle tissue to expand and grow to compensate. Now, you can go beyond that and actually tear the muscle and destroy it. But there's a certain point in there where you're doing somewhat of a damage. In other words, you're stretching it beyond what it can actually handle enough so that the body will then compensate by strengthening it. Well, that's what God's doing to us spiritually. You know, that's why it hurts a little bit sometimes to get stretched. It's like when dancing first started, you know. Go out there and dance for 2 minutes and collapse. Oh, my legs. Now, maybe we can go 5 minutes. Or, depends on what song is on, right? Procession of the King, once through and you go, I can't hardly control myself. By the time I've gone twice through that song and I collapse at the end of it because I just totally give myself to it. And I can't help it. That draws my spirit so deeply that the body just, I said, okay, this is all out here. We give everything 100%. But it's kind of like that, you know, we're being stretched a bit. God is drawing us into things. It's interesting. If you look at this move, God, you know, dancing. It first started up with, you know, kind of bouncing around and people shove, you know, a little bit of that. And people got more free and more free and more free. And then pretty soon people were dancing around in a circle. I mean, that was a major step at that time. To get people to go even around in a circle together. Before it was just, you know, just between you and the Lord, see. Well, the walls begin to break down. So then more walls and more walls and more walls and more walls. Now look what's happening. But see, not everybody's moved into that yet. Not everybody's moved into it. Not everybody accepts it. That's why you still hear the testimonies that are coming forth. Because there's a lot of people that haven't moved into it. But God is taking us in a process. He's stretching us. You know, this is what he wants to do. If at the beginning of dancing, he just poured out this whole intimacy movement right at the start, I mean, there'd be 50 people in the church. There'd been such raging manifest. I mean, there'd people walked out in droves. Really. That's the truth. And the probability is that we would have been part of it. You know? But God is merciful. He takes us a step at a time. And this is what's happening with Jeremiah's ministry. See, Jeremiah got to start his ministry, which God knew was going to be a very difficult ministry. He got to start it during the time of Josiah. That's why he's saying here, if you've run with the footmen and you're wearied, And if you have prophesied in the land of peace, or if you, and if in the land of peace, in other words, you've done your ministry in the land of peace, because it's basically a peaceful time right now, then what are you going to do when things get tough? What are you going to do when you have to run with the horses? When the Jordan starts to swell and the lions are coming forth? When the land starts getting really rough, what are you going to do? What we need to do is not be complaining, but asking God, okay, stretch me, keep teaching me, keep training me. This is something that God spoke to my heart about probably 4 or 5 years ago. I recognized that He said, we're a brand new bottle, you know, and of course that's speaking of a wineskin. And the reason we're to be that new wineskin is because the new wineskin stretches. Now, it's interesting. You take a wine, it's like a balloon, you know. If you say you're going to put water, or you're just going to blow it up. You can blow it up to a certain point, and I mean, if you didn't know a lot about balloons, you'd think, well, that thing's going to burst. But then you find that if you blow more into it, it stretches some more. And stretches some more, some more, some more, some more. You know, eventually there's a breaking limit on those guys, on a balloon or something like that. But that's the way a wineskin is too. You put the wine in, and what you find out is that, I mean, it fills up. It's full. Okay. But wait a while. The moisture and the weight begin to stretch. Pretty soon it's not full anymore. You can add more wine. And more, and more. And so I made a decision before the Lord. Well, Lord, if that's what it's like, then what I'm going to allow you to do is stretch me. Now, in the natural, there's a breaking limit. But it's kind of like we've got this super stretchy balloon for our soul and spirit, so to speak, in our relationship with the Lord and what we can handle in God. But we don't know that it's super stretchy. We think that, whoa, I'm going to pop. You know? But God's going to go, and then we'll go, I'm sure I'm going to pop now. But in reality, He's going to keep expanding us, causing us to grow and receive more of His Spirit. You know, it's like the love that's being experienced. If you experienced the level of love you're experiencing right now, 2 years ago, you would have popped. Because we're kind of all tied up and, you know, there was a lot of chains on the heart, you know, and a lot of things binding it up. And so you would have had these little two open areas over here going, you know, if you've ever taken a balloon and, you know, like held it in your hands and blow it up, you know, it starts coming through the cracks, you know, and the little cracks, little, you know. Well, those will pop because they're getting overstretched. You'd have popped. But God's unbinding the heart. And He's loosing up our conscience, too. To where our conscience is expanding to what God allows. See? This is what's happening. He gave us a conscience and we needed it to keep us stable and in the boat. You know? But He says, I don't want you to live by your conscience. I want you to live by my Spirit. But what we have to do here is I can't just take away your conscience because you're not spiritual enough yet. You'll just go off the bluff. So what we're going to do is we're going to keep working all these traditions out of your life and all these things that have bound you up and all these false concepts you've had and all these ingrained traditions that you've had. And I'm going to let your conscience expand until it reaches what my will allows. Because then we'll be, what will we be doing? We'll be walking in the Spirit, and we will in no wise fulfill the lust of the flesh. So that's what He's doing with us. He's unbinding us, He's loosening us up, He's causing us to see how stretchy a balloon we have, so to speak. It's really a precious thing. So that we can contend with the horsemen when the time comes. We'll be able to. God's going to stretch us. We need to be aware that He's going to be able to do it. But He's training us right now. Paul?
You said during the swelling of Jordan, the lions come out.
When Jordan swelled, you know, if you've ever seen a picture of the river valley of Jordan, it's real low, it's real close to the water table, Okay, very green, but very narrow. So when the rains would swell the Jordan, it would overflow its banks and spread out over a large area. Well, as it did, you know, lions, they're not much for water, you know. They don't like swimming in the water. So they come up, they're being forced out of their thickets. And so what they do is they come up onto the higher land, see. And so the lions are coming forth. That's speaking of the lions that will come forth. This used to happen. The lions would come out and start attacking the people, see. Because they're being driven out of their normal abode and where they normally feed. And so they would come up and feed upon other folk, sheep and other things, you know. And it was a fearful thing, you can imagine, you know. You're used to everything peace and quiet, and here comes this lion bounding through your front yard, you know. And you don't have bars on your windows and things, you know. I remember living in Alaska, used to have a moose walk through the front yard. Mom locked the door then, you know. I mean, you didn't want the kids out there because she'd come through with her calf. And that's a very dangerous situation. But, you know, I mean, can you imagine? If you basically don't have, yeah, maybe you have shutters and things, but here comes a lion, you know. It'd be really scary. But we have to be in that place where we're ready when those come up. You know, the lion is representing demon forces, representing Satan himself coming about as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. We need to be in a place where we're ready. The horses represent power. There's a real warfare. I mean, the devil's still being held back. You know, God is holding him back from us. We're moving into new places in power, but He really has to train us. So this is what he's speaking about. Jeremiah, listen, you're still in kiddie land here. And, you know, you need to recognize that things are going to get a little tough yet. You might compare 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 41 through 46. This is the story of Elijah on Carmel, Mount Carmel, telling Ahab to go because the rain was coming, then girding up his loins and running ahead of him. By the Spirit of the Lord, by the power of God, he did that. We need to be in a place where we can see that and be prepared for it and go, so that when the Spirit of the Lord says, we go, and we will outrun the horsemen. We will outrun the horsemen. Verse 6. Where are we at? Chapter 12, right? Mm-hmm. For even thy brethren and the house of thy father, even they have dealt treacherously with thee. Yea, they have called a multitude after thee. Believe them not, though they speak fair words unto thee. Interesting, his brethren. You know, who will our enemies be in the last day? They of your own household. That's who the enemies will be. His own brethren, his natural brothers and sisters, etc., his family, were coming after him saying, Jeremiah, come on now, pay attention. You're all wrong. You're all washed up. Look, we're trying to save your life. Compromise the calling of God. They're not saying that directly. They're pleading with him. They're crying out after him. But in reality, they betrayed him. See, when he wouldn't listen, this is like Jesus' brethren, his actual brothers. They feared for him. I mean, they thought that, well, there's something wrong here. They didn't understand. So this is Jeremiah's own brother. So they betrayed him. Judas betrayed Jesus, you know, as it were they of his own household. Those that were closest to him betrayed him. So his own brethren, Jeremiah's own family, is betraying him here. They're dealing treacherously. That's what it means to deal treacherously. He betrayed them. They've called a multitude after thee. They cried out with a full voice after thee. They've been railing on him. They've been, you know, it probably started out first with Jeremiah. Pay attention. You must be off. You've got to be wrong. Come on. Listen, you know, maybe some of you have experienced this with your own families. Look, I know you love God and everything, but really, that church is kind of fanatical. You know, I mean, why don't you go to some nice, quiet church where you can grow and just be a nice spiritual boy there, or girl, you know, and marry some nice man and live in a nice house, and, you know, and you can go to church every Sunday and everything will be just fine, and Mom and Dad and I, we'll just be so happy for you. Do you have to go somewhere where they get printed up in the newspaper, you know? Do you have to go there? Couldn't you go someplace nice? You know, look, we'll send you to seminary. you know. We'll send you to the cemetery. We'd be glad to do that. Go to secular college. Come on, just do this to please your mom and dad. But later it becomes, you know, maybe a little harder, a little harsher. Hopefully it doesn't, but it depends. Some situations, sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. Verse 7. Now this is God speaking of Israel and Judah. I have forsaken mine house. I have left mine heritage. I have given the dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies. It's a sad thing. His own house, his own heritage. See, they were to be the inheritance of God. And he has had to give those, the beloved of his soul, the dearest to him, he has to give them up into the hand of her enemies. Because they won't walk with him. Verse 8. Mine heritage is unto me as a lion in the forest. It crieth out against me. Therefore have I hated it. Those are strong words. And pained words. As a lion, it says. Mine heritage is as a lion in the forest. That is fierce, wild, untamed. That's what his people have become to him. They go about rending one another. It crieth out against me, therefore have I hated it. This is a justifiable withdrawal of God's love because of sin. Now, it's not that he doesn't love the people per se, but he hates what they've done. He hates how they've turned their hearts against him. He hates that. He planted them a noble vine, and they become the strange vine of a degenerate plant. This hating here is represents an emotional feeling. It's kind of an anthropomorphism here. We're attributing human attributes to God. It's a desire to not be in contact with the object of hate. He doesn't want to be in contact with his people. It's too painful. He is holy. They're sinful. He doesn't want to be in contact with them. In other places, he said he's hated their feasts. He's hated their sacrifices. He's hated their praise. Because their hearts are wrong. They fulfilled the law, but it was a howling din. Clanging cymbal. Because it wasn't done from love. That was the problem with the Pharisees. If you remember from your perspectives class, there were seven types of Pharisees. At least the Pharisees listed seven types. And one of them was a Pharisee of love. One who served God and followed the law out of love for God. See, Simon the Pharisee may have been one of those. And those Pharisees who did follow Christ, after all, they were Pharisees of love, basically. They were ones that... See, it's like Paul. Paul was a Pharisee of Pharisees, but he was a Pharisee of love. He thought, he said, I have walked before God in all good conscience unto today. They wanted to kill him because he said such a statement. But in his heart, he said, I've wanted God. All I've wanted is God. That's all I've wanted. And this is what I got. I was deceived by Phariseeism. That's why God came to him. Not because he was the most wicked, evil, in his heart, Pharisee. No. Those are the ones that were the generation of vipers that wouldn't walk with God. And those are the same ones that who, having seen Jesus himself, seeing again on the road to Damascus, would not have converted. But he was under deception, and so God came to him because he was a Pharisee of love. He loved God with all of his heart. He was just deceived. So God brought him truth, and he turned. The hearts were wrong. Verse 9. Mine heritage is unto me as a speckled bird. The birds round about are against her. Come ye, assemble all the beasts of the field. Come to devour. A speckled bird. In the Hebrew, it's a spotted or variegated bird of prey. The spotted coloring, that is, represents a blending of paganism with Mosaic ritual. That's what the spotting is. We see in Revelation chapter 3, verse 16, same kind of thing. I would that thou wert hot or cold. But because thou art lukewarm, I will spew thee out or vomit you out. God hates what is called syncretism. That's a mixing. He said, I'd rather have you be in heathenism totally or following me totally. But when you mix the two, you not only blaspheme my name, but you become totally unclean. And you know, the hardest people to speak to about the gospel, the hardest people to convince sometimes, are what you would call nominal Christians in denominational settings, who are not really born again but think they are, because they have a knowledge of God, but they deny the power thereof. I have to end the class, but if you have a comment for the class. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Well, we didn't cover a lot of verses today, but we covered a lot of ground.